This is August 9th, 2009, and for today's abbreviated Teisho, I'm just going to talk about the matter of process over product. I'll explain as we go on, of course. This got started with a meeting we had this week at Chapin Mill about the courtyard, the central courtyard at Chapin Mill. We're not satisfied with it the way it is. It's a huge improvement over what it has been. We now have really a courtyard there, it's handsome enough in its own way. It's some beautiful plantings there. It's gives a sense of serenity and restfulness. But I feel, and others agree, that it lacks something. There's something a little static. These are my words, static about it. There's something a little bit too safe about it. Someone said suburban. And so, because we know we can do better, eventually, we had a meeting out there this week with Todd McGrain, who is the brother-in-law of one of our members. Todd is a professor of sculpture at Cornell, and is a very gifted sculptor himself. He did the monument that sits in the Founders Garden here at Arnold Park, that massive stone. He spent months looking for just the right granite, and we got a crane in, and we lowered it in, and after he worked on it, as the polished surface, and I think most everyone, if not everyone, is very pleased with what it presents there as a memorial to Roshi Kaplow, our founder. And knowing of his gifts, we felt that he might give us a fresh perspective on the courtyard. The courtyard design was drawn up by a landscape architect whom we've used for our gardens near the building at Chapin Mill, he was working off of meetings, earlier meetings, where those of us in the Chapin Mill Building Committee and the Gardens and Grounds Committee gave him our general views on what we'd want for a courtyard, and then he drew up several designs, and we chose one of them mostly, and then we implemented it. And this was done over last summer and this summer, and what we have there is pretty nice, but nothing to write home about. And so we went out there with an open mind of wanting just to hear what the sculptor would have to say about it. And he agreed that we can do better, that it's a good start, but there's more we can do. There's no rush. We'll do this as we can. But what got me onto this topic for Teisho is that he began by talking about his process of working in sculpture, and it struck me as exactly what we want to develop through Zen practice. This is what he said, more or less. I'm, of course, paraphrasing. He said, as a sculptor, I'm working with malleable material. I'm working with clay. And I don't start off with any hard and fast design. I sit before this big lump of clay. I work it, and I look at it. And then I work it some more. I see what it might need, and I try that. And I look at it, I stand back, and then I work it some more, and so forth. He says, I just can't work in a way where I stack up the steps of what I'm going to do. And this, I think I feel is just a beautiful model for practice, and of course just about all forms of art, any kind of creative work. We know this is true to a great extent in writing. You start from nothing, and you just start writing, and you rewrite, and sometimes rewrite. I once read something by some famous writers commenting on, in one sentence, commenting on what they think is the key to writing. And more than one of them said, the secret to writing is rewriting. Well, there are limitations to that. You have to come out with a book, and then it's done. And most authors would like to be able to just keep changing it as they think of other things, but you just have to put it to bed sooner or later. But there is that process of just openness to what you're putting down there, openness to the material. E.L. Doctorow, the novelist, said, writing is like driving a car at night. You can only see as far as the headlights, but you can get all the way there that way. I talked to one of our members who was here from Italy, who has done a lot of sailing. He spent 15 years sailing through the West Indies, and he was saying that in sailing too, you start off with a destination. You want to get from point A to point B, but then on your way there you run into winds that you hadn't expected, and so you know that by going to point C is your better way of getting to point B. Well, I think this is pretty obvious to most people. As far as the various arts, Rilke well, I'm going to hold off on that because there's more I want to say before quoting Rilke. But the same would be not just art as we normally think of it, art in the narrow sense, but the art of anything, the art of psychotherapy, let's say. What you have before you is a human being, which means someone who is in flux, someone who's changing. And yes, you may start out with a treatment plan, which is what the insurance companies want in order to reimburse for the hours. So you may have some general idea of diagnosis and what how to proceed. But then, of course, you have to respond to and adapt to what is in front of you, who is in front of you. And that's going to be different from session to session to some degree. Same with a teacher. Teacher comes to know his students, the basic temperament and the basic grain of a student. You don't change that overnight, or in sometimes never. But you work with the grain. It's one of the challenges of teaching, as it is in woodworking, is you just see with what you're where you're going, what you've got, but you can't see that far ahead. If you try to go at it with some hard and fast plan, then you're not going to be very good at it. It's much the same actually with Taisho. I have to come up with a topic in order to have a frame around my talk, as I have this morning. But it would not be a Taisho if I wrote it out, typed it out, and read it. That's something else. It has to come from the moment. And maybe this is why I respond so strongly to Todd's way of working, is because I've learned that if I have things too thought out ahead of time, never mind written out, that's out of the question. But if I have things thought out too far ahead of time, then it may feel already stale and not of the moment when Sunday morning comes around. So I've learned to trust not knowing for sure what I'm going to do. And often it is really pretty much at the last minute that something comes to me and it seems, for me, perfect at that time. And then it's got life to it. It's not based on a thought or a plan. Of course, we need to make designs. We don't have the luxury of working with the material on an ongoing basis and adapting. For example, when designing a house or a retreat center, you have to know where you're going when you do the excavation and lay the foundation and then put up the framing and so forth. Of course, we need to have blueprints and then stick to those blueprints. Not to do so, of course, you don't have to. You can redo things, but it's usually too much expense. So you just live with flaws, the mistakes that you made, but with something organic and as living as a courtyard, where you don't have, you know, things built up vertically, then you can rework it, and it's the reworking of it that is how we get to really a place of relative satisfaction with it. My perspective on this is based on, also informed by my experience at some of the world famous Buddhist caves in India and in China, where these caves were slowly built over hundreds of years. The Ajanta caves in India were built over, I think, something like 900 years, sculpted out of granite, the magnificent Buddha figures and other religious religious sculptures. The Ellora Caves, the same, hundreds of years. And caves in China, Buddhist caves in China that we visited, that also took a long, long, long time. Well, we don't have to take hundreds of years in order to make this an ongoing organic process where we allow what needs to unfold to unfold. Rilke referred to the quiet, deep probability of the wise man is trustful towards unexplored complexities. He wrote a lot about art. When he referred to art, it's often the equivalent of what we would call spiritual practice. And it's what we're doing when we do Zen meditation, Zazen. This is the real quintessential work of adapting and having the trust to dispense with a plan. Practice is always, right, first of all, of course, it is letting go of notions about where we're going. And this is true of all the mystical traditions. I think St. John of the Cross said, going I know not where by a road I know not of. He also said, if one wishes to be sure of the road he treads on, he must close his eyes and walk in the dark. The dark. This means, of course, not knowing where we're going for sure, not having an end point fixed in our mind, but willing to feel our way, to grope through the darkness and trust that we will find our way as time goes on. That's what Zazen is. At its best, Zazen is a state of darkness. Darkness simply meaning not knowing. There's a famous exchange where the great Chinese master Zhou Zhou was asked by a monk, "To where is your mind focused?" And he said, "Where there is no design." Now, he was talking about, no doubt, Zhoshu, at this time in ancient China, the 700s and 800s, this is before koans emerged as a system, and the predominant practice was what we would call shikantaza, Japanese word meaning just sitting, with no focus, not even focusing on the breath, you're just sitting, wide open, wide awake, aware, in touch. It's a very advanced practice, very difficult. And even with breath practice and koan practice, which are practices of focusing the mind, they will eventually deliver us to this place of darkness. That's really what these various practices all have in common, is to get us to let go of any preconceived notion about a goal, a place where we want to go, and just let go and open up to to not knowing. It's recognizing the dynamic nature of reality. Things are not fixed. The Roshi Kapler used to quote this Japanese proverb, "The devil laughs at he who plans for next year." And yet sometimes we need to plan for next year. People beg us for sesshin dates of sesshin, for at least a year in advance, because they have to commit on their schedule, some people, and so we do that. We didn't used to, but now we do. Have to plan ahead to make trips. There's a place for planning and sticking, committing to dates or plans. But so often we do this when it's not called for at all. Why? Why do we latch on to goals and plans when they're really not necessary? Why do we cling to designs where no design is really called for? Well, I think because of insecurity. Many people are frightened by the dark. They need to have something. They don't really need, excuse me, they want, they think they need to have something to hold on to in their mind. It gives them a sense of purpose or security. There are also just a difference of style. There are people I've come to see, there are people who are closure people and those who are non-closure people. The closure people, they want things spelled out and they want things clear and they want to know where they're going and they want to know, get things tied up and all the I's dotted and the T's crossed and everything clear and fixed, set. And those people have a lot to contribute to in all kinds of ways. And then there are people who typically avoid that. They're not comfortable with tying everything out and closing the doors and closing off options, and who want to stay open, to be able to adapt and change. These can be very ordinary kinds of examples of making an appointment with someone. Some people love to get those appointments nailed down. Okay. And that certainly has its value at times. Other people hate that. And those people too, there's some, what's the resistance about? You can't make an appointment and stick to it. It's I think being one of those people with one of those tendencies, it's a kind of a greed. You don't want to foreclose any options. You want to leave all your options open so you can maximize whatever pleasure or you can get what you want, most likely be able to get what you want if you have the freedom to do that. So it's not a judgmental thing about people who need to have their plans and all their ducks in a row, are those who resist that. But for those who really feel compelled to get everything stacked up when it's not necessary, that is, then there is, I believe, it's a fear of the unknown. It's a fear of letting go and relinquishing control, I guess, is what it comes down to, just relinquishing control. So we, each of us, gets to know our grain. Whether we're the more controlling or the less, more open, more closure type, the less non-closure type, and we can sort of respect our way and not get judgmental about that, and then work with it and never sit back and just resign ourselves to being too extreme in either side, and above all to be aware of what neurotic tendencies may be behind our particular style. But back to practice. the essence of practice, really. The essence is letting go, being open. Being one with what is before us, and of course that's always shifting. In our sitting on one day, things will be one way. Let's say we'll be kind of tired. We'll have more thoughts. We'll be grumpy. We'll be whatever we're bringing. We have more pain in the legs than usual. Thoughts may just be more stubborn, persistent in the mind, and then to impose a notion about the way things should be is just a sure way of making ourselves miserable. So a lot of this comes down to just faith. Faith that things are what they are, and that despite how wrong things may seem, how bad things may seem in our practice, that there is some underlying order to it or some wisdom behind it. This is something one has to come to in Sesshin, especially when we're facing ourselves so nakedly. Day in and day out, sooner or later you will arrive at that point of that letting go and just opening to what is before us and not trying to impose a design or notions about the way it should be. And to become one with, here's that Rilke quote I was going to do earlier. He talks about artist, I would say, you know, the practitioner, Zen practitioner, or really anyone in what are widely called the mystical traditions. The mystical traditions are where you let go of theology and dogma, and you just open yourself to things as they are before you. And when he talks about love, I would substitute, just in terms of this quote, I would substitute that which gives rise to love, which is oneness, becoming one with. So this is especially suited to koan work. Where the wise man endeavors to solve enigmas, the artist has a far greater task, or, if you will, a still greater right. The artist's function is to love the enigma. All art is this love. Love which has been poured out over enigmas. And all works of art are enigmas surrounded, adorned, enveloped by love. I hear him saying, if we are one with the practice, whether it's a koan or breath practice, if we just pour ourselves into it, not knowing where we're going, or as one Zen master said, to proceed toward the obscure and unknown through the still obscure and unknown. That's really the essence of the mystical tradition. To do this will reveal not an answer, what we think of as an answer that's going to be up there somewhere in the future, but it will bring understanding. There's a difference between an answer and understanding. Becoming one with is a way to understand, really understand. Roshi Kaplow used to quote someone, I don't think he ever knew himself who it was, it doesn't matter, this is truth. He said, if you want to understand someone, you need to love them. But once you love them, you don't need to understand them. It's perfect, perfect advice. Possibly the best, best principle one can work with in a marriage or in any intimate relationship. If you want to understand someone, love them. Once you love them, you don't need to understand them. It also is this applies to going to Doksan. Doksan, for those of you who are new, Doksan is the word we use for the private one-to-one encounter between a teacher and a student in Zen. And many people begin when they go to Doksan. They or for the first few times or more usually it's first few years of going to Doksan, they feel they need to come up with something to take into Doksan, a question or a problem or something. There's a lot of rehearsing that people do before they figure out how this works. They sit in the Zendo before going to Doksan and think they got to get all their words in line and figure out a nice way of expressing the thing, and God forbid you should go in with an empty mind. But really, this too, going to Doksan, is improvising. That's what we're talking about here, I guess. It's what Todd McGrain is talking about, and his working in our courtyard is improvising. And a wonderful, wonderful words from Bobby McFerrin, the musician. Don't worry, be happy. Remember that song? I guess that'd be advice for anyone as they're about to go to Doksan. Don't worry, be happy. So he was asked, "You are known for your improvised solo concerts. Can you explain how that works, the process of musical improvisation?" And this is what he said. "The process is very easy to explain. Improvisation is basically motion. You simply sing one note and then another note. Or you play one note and then you follow it with another. Even if it's rambling and you don't know what you're doing, you're still improvising because you don't really need a lot of musical knowledge. I'm not even sure if you need any at all, because anybody can physically move their fingers on the keyboard or the violin, or the flute, or whatever they're playing. Singers can open up their mouths and just sing one note after another. That's the motion of improvisation. And the true virtuosos who really do it well are the ones who sort of face the fear of the unknown and are constantly making themselves move into it without really seeing what the next step is going to be. Now, that's the hardest part of improv. Getting over the fear of doing it." But then that's also the real life. That's the richness, the vitality of any art, including the art of going to Doksan and the art of giving Doksan. I don't have any plans, even when I see who's walking through the door. If I had any plans about any strategies about how to work with that student, then it wouldn't be real Doksan. Just as the same as Taisho. Not to make an absolute out of that. Sometimes when I see someone, I right away have a thought of something I wanted to point out or bring up. But the real zest, the real life of Doksan, as it is of teaching and relationships and psychotherapy and courtyard design, is to be fully attuned to what's before us right now. When we do have the freedom to adapt, to shift, and to change things, then How wonderful. Not to have to operate out of a design. So we're not stacking up decisions about how we might change the courtyard. We're just going to take one step first. And for those of you who've seen the courtyard, we're going to start by removing the pavers that are in the center of the courtyard. These are paving stones. We're going to remove all those, and we're going to remove the beds of stones around the two Japanese maples. And we don't know what we're going to do after that. We're going to start by taking that out, and then Todd will come back, and we'll all meet again. We'll look at it, size it up, see where we might want to go from there. It's exciting. It's fun. And there's no rush to it. I said to the others who are going to be implementing this, that there's no rush. We don't have to do that this year. If you have the time, sure. If you on your priority list, if you have the time, go ahead. But otherwise, wait till next year for just this step one. And then we'll take another look at it and go to step two and so forth. Well, our time is oh, just one little historical note. With our own gardens here at Arnold Park, behind the Five Arnold Park, what is now these sort of mounds of grass and lawn, mounds of grass and a winding brick path through there. That originally we made those mounds at the direction of a world famous landscape architect. Sold us on making what he called a dry stream bed. So everything now that is red brick back there behind the Five Arnold Park looked like a dry stream. Stones, gravel, and stepping stones and things. And we tried it for, I don't know, a year or two. And we came to realize that It just wasn't functional enough. We no one wanted to walk with bare feet or on that rough, dry stream bed, and we realized through consensus that we needed to make it more inviting to people to walk on, and so we changed it. So we do have this in our own background, our own history, and I have great expectations, hopes that this will come to be just what we want. Not just something that's good enough, but something that can be remarkable, with possibly with a sculpture there that already we've been promised will be paid for, a sculpture, a fountain possibly. So please, those of you who tend to be critical of things that are done, if you can try to suspend that and just sort of move along, be open to what might come of this, and if you don't have experience in landscape design or sculpture, you might not be too sure about your opinions about the way things should be. And we'll see how all this unfolds. We'll stop now and recite the four vows.